So welcome everyone. Thank you for coming on this Sunday morning. And for those of you who've been coming before, you know this is our first meditation up here in what is our meditation hall. So it's somewhat auspicious. I want to express my personal gratitude to those people who have made it possible, which includes also the people who were in this John Calvin Church for many years before we came here. But also within our own community, so many people who financially gave to help with the renovation, and of course the many people who have given time, energy, their labor to make this all possible. So this is the coming together of many, many variables, in addition to many more than I'm naming. But I want to express my gratitude, appreciation to everyone. Speaking of gratitude and appreciation, for those of you who maybe have never been here before, or fairly new, you may wonder what all the bowing's about. Since I think generally in our culture we do not bow to each other, but in other cultures, especially the cultures where Buddhism arose, sort of bowing is a way that people have of greeting each other, just the way we shake hands. So it's not that special. I mean, it's the way people greet and acknowledge each other. But also in the context of more sacred endeavors, it is a very meaningful way to show respect. That's really what it's about. And the reason during the course of our meditations, we may bow to each other, or we may bow to the Buddha. This is just our way of paying respect and really acknowledging, that we didn't make this all up, and we didn't kind of spring spontaneously here, but that we are only here because of others. And we could certainly say that it is only because of the Buddha, even as remote as over 2,500 years ago in northern India seems, and all the continuing teachers and students from the original time of the Buddha and his disciples, we are only here because of them. As well as, and this means not only that we are here doing these practices, but that we have the availability of these marvelous teachings that have encapsulated so much that is inherently intelligent, sane, wise, about what it means to be a human being. We call things Buddhism, or we give names to things, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, but these are just names that refer to really this wonderful capacity that human beings have had for thousands of years to look beyond everyday life, the everyday up and down of life, the everyday dramas of life, and to look more deeply into what life's really about, and what happiness is about, and what meaning and purpose is about. And again, we are quite fortunate that hundreds of thousands, if not millions and millions and millions of people of all kinds, for these thousands of years have been willing to step out of their ordinary everyday existence to feed and shelter themselves and advance themselves, et cetera, but have really looked deeply into that. And that is why we are here today, and that is why we stop and pay respect. So when you see images of the Buddha, things like that, that we bow to, we're just acknowledging our connection with that tradition and that lineage. But also because a Buddha only is a word that is given to an ordinary human being like ourselves who has realized their Buddha mind, which means their inherent capacity to live in an awakened way. when we bow to the Buddha, we are bowing really at the deepest level to the capacity within each of us to lead an awakened life and to acknowledge that each of us have a Buddha nature, that through our practice of various types, we are awakening this Buddha within us. And then, of course, we bow to each other, which is a way of acknowledging, you know, again, we're not alone. And even though we meet like in a day like this in silent meditation, we are aware that it's nice to not be alone and to have other people here to practice with us, support us. It makes it easier, right? It makes it easier. So in our bowing to each other, that's all we're doing. I think, as many of you know, but I would imagine most of you get emails from us, that our community, which doesn't mean just the Tampa, but our community, the Florida Community of Mindfulness, which means the members of our community, and as well as you know, people who aren't members but who participate in our events, we are involved in a theme journey that began in January and will continue through June. I mean, we are in a theme journey for our life, but we are kind of segmented and saying, let's give special attention or focus. And I wrote down, we are calling this theme journey, Letting Go of Self-Centered Living, the Path of Selflessness. And what we hope to do is, over the course of these 6 months, in our various practice events, Dharma talks, discussions, workshops, retreats, intensives, really focus on this central issue. I think that is very meaningful to all of us. Letting go of self-centered living, the path of selflessness. It's a wonderful topic, and has so many permutations and so many ways that this dichotomy between selfishness, self-centeredness, I guess it's an extreme, we could call it narcissistic, totally self-absorbed way of living, as opposed to a way of living that acknowledges that there are others. We do find that hard to believe at times because we are very absorbed in ourself, in our own needs, our own wants, our own issues. We often are surprised to look around and see there are other people. Even there may be even people in our own homes who we are not often that aware of. Not aware of and simply aware of their physical presence, but really aware of them. In a really acknowledgement of the deep interconnection we have with each other, and that they are essential. And they are probably more essential than we are, because without other people, how would we develop the capacity to love? How would we develop the capacity to be caring human beings? How would we develop patience? How would we develop the capacity of being generous? I mean, I could go on, but it is only because of other beings, other people, that we even have these capacities. So there are many, many reasons. You know, I want to talk actually about the Four Immeasurables a little bit today, but there is a wonderful text, and probably during the course of this, actually this has been a text that we have in our community over the years, have spent much time in study and practice. And by the way, parenthetically, I mean, as many of you know, within our community for the past 3 months in the fall and now, beginning actually tomorrow for the next 3 months, 3.5 months, we have about 60, 65 people in our community involved in an intensive process of study and practice on the topic, deconstructing the myth of self. For those of you who grounded in Western psychology, you may be surprised that there are people in the world who consider the self, the ego, to be a myth, but there are. even though if you go to college or you go to high school and you take your intro to psych courses, you will believe that the field of psychology began about 100 years ago with people like Freud, etc. That is not true. That is hubris. That is arrogance. There have been people looking deeply into the mind and what causes suffering and how to free people from suffering and all the permutations of that for thousands of years. And this is not to to put down Western psychology. I spent my professional life involved in it, but this is also to be aware that this is not new and that there is a profound understanding of the mind and the self that precedes us and will only, if we're willing to open ourselves to that body and stream of knowledge, it will only enhance what Western psychology and psychotherapy has developed over the past 50 plus years. But anyhow, so we're in the deconstructing the myth of self. We just had a retreat here in Tampa at the Franciscan Center dealing with the issue of self. And this text by Shantideva, The Way of the Bodhisattva, is really a very wonderful text. He's a great 8th century Indian master who wrote incredibly profoundly on all the matters of living a selfless life. But I just want to read a few here, this is in the first chapter, and these are, and actually this is poetry. I mean, he wrote this in verse, so it's only profound. it's quite beautiful. So this is verse 21 of the first chapter. He says, if with kindly generosity one merely has the wish to soothe the aching heads of beings, such merit knows no bounds. So he's earned, you know, just ordinary kindness. You know, we want to soothe the aching of another being. No need, then, to speak of the wish to drive away the endless pain of each and every living being, bringing them unbounded excellence. So he's saying, you know, a good person wants to help people around them soothe their breath. But he said, how much more so does someone who actually dedicates their life to driving away the endless pain of each and every living being? Now, again, there's a lot involved in this. And these are what we'll be covering over these next months. Could our father or our mother ever have such generous a wish? I mean, maybe we did have good parents who taught us to be kind to other people, or to be good to other people, or to be charitable. But did they ever teach us that each of us have this capacity to be of benefit to everyone, and that that actually is the purpose, the deepest purpose and meaning of life? For in the past, they never, even in their dreams, wished something like this even for themselves. How could they do it for another's sake? This aim is to bring about the benefit of beings, a benefit that others wish, not even for themselves. Right. How many individuals actually, within their minds, actually have the thought, may I be free of all my sufferings. Completely free of all suffering. And may I live with a mind that only knows kindness, generosity, goodness, peacefulness, calmness, openness. You know what I'm saying? How many of even generate that wish for ourselves? He's saying, much less for everyone. Yeah. I mean, it's also beautiful. And then he said, if the simple thought to be of help to others exceeds in worth the worship of the Buddha. So it's making it very interesting. I mean, he's a Buddhist monk, and he's saying, as opposed to the, religiosity, all the religious ritual acts of religion, such as here he said, worship the Buddhas, he said, if the simple thought of wanting to benefit others exceeds in worth the worship of the Buddhas, what need is there to speak of actual deeds that bring about the weal and benefit of beings? So he's saying, how wonderful it is to have these kinds of thoughts and intentions, how much better to actually live it. And this, to me, is a very powerful line. Again, I'm just sharing with this to you. This is our beginning of this 6 months, 5 months journey. For beings long to free themselves from misery, but misery itself they follow and pursue. They long for joy, but in their ignorance destroy it as they would their foe. I mean, there's such, I think, personal meaning in that for each of us. For beings long to free themselves from misery, whether consciously or unconsciously. All beings don't want to suffer. We consider that pathological. Right? If somebody says, oh yes, I enjoy suffering, we consider that pathological. All beings want freedom from suffering. And they want it, hopefully, for themselves. And most beings want it for people they love, they care about. They would say, yes, I'd like my children, my relatives, my friends, I'd like them all to be free from misery. And yet, he says, but misery itself they follow and pursue. And yet, if you look, you're aware of this deep intention, if you ask people, and yet if you were present to the way so many people go about their lives, they are involved in activities of thought, of emotion, activities of speech, and all the activities of their life and relationships that doesn't fulfill, that is not congruent with their deepest aspiration. But misery, they want to be free of misery, but misery itself they follow and pursue. They long for joy. Who would not say yes? I would like to live my life in joy. Right? I'm not talking about some kind of drug-induced ecstatic bliss. Just a simple joy. A simple joy. From when we get up to we go through our day. To approach all the activities of our life with a quiet sense of joy, well-being. We long for it, but in their ignorance we destroy it, as they would a foe. Right? But those who fill with bliss all beings destitute of joy, who cut all pain and suffering away, from those weighed down with misery, who drive away the darkness of ignorance, what virtue could be matched with theirs? What friend could be compared to them? What merit is similar to this? And then just one more. I mean, again, we'll be delving back in, but another, I think, that is germane to our undertaking. And again, and there may be those of you who want to be part of this kind of general focusing on this topic of letting go of self-centered living, the path of selflessness, and of course, hopefully, many of us are involved in that in our own way. But if not, it's good to be aware of this capacity that we all have. And these are very famous lines from Santideva. This is much later in the text. He says, all the joy the world contains has come through wishing happiness for others. All the misery the world contains has come through wanting pleasure only for oneself. And then in the next verse he says, Is there need for lengthy explanation? Childish beings look out for themselves. Buddhas, and we can all call ourselves Buddhas in training, Buddhas labor for the good of others. See the difference that divides them. And let me just read those two again. All the joy the world contains has come through the wishing happiness for others. All the misery the world contains has come through wanting pleasure for oneself. Is there need for lengthy explanation? Childish beings look out for themselves. Interesting, right? From a developmental point of view, we accept that one of the characteristics of being a child is they are totally focused on what? Themselves. Right? And we accept that as normal. We even often find that cute. Amusing. But as we live with our children, and we live with them over the years, or we live with ourselves, one would expect what? That there is a growing awareness that there are others in the world, and that their needs and wants are not the center of the universe. And the rest of us are not here simply to meet their needs and wants. When they are little children, when they are babies, they see. We saw the adults around us as being there for only one purpose, to meet our needs, to take care of us. But hopefully, then we kind of take a developmental journey that as we go through our childhood extends, we begin to notice what? Other people. And we start getting messages from the adults around us, hopefully, that what? Yeah, you have to learn to do some things for yourself. And also, relationships are mutual, right? We kind of do for each other. And for many children, they do not like that, as you know. And they kind of develop that way, and then we know in adolescence, all of a sudden, it's kind of complete reversion. And once again, life is only about me. Right? In a way that is no longer cute, the way it was when they were 3 and 4 and 5. When they're 13, 14, 15, 16, it is no longer cute. Endearing when that overweening narcissistic selfishness rears its head. But again, we are patient and understanding. And it is our hope that with good guidance and with good learning and experience, that child will then move into what? Some sort of adulthood where a more meaningful connection with the world and fellow human beings, and they learn to be capable of establishing relationships with the world, with people, with work, with society, in which one is not so self-centered and which one begins to reach out and connect in a good way, in a helpful way, in a compassionate way with the world around. Is there need for length explanation? Childish beings look out for themselves. So, you know, it's interesting because many people, there's a lot of talk these days about that many people refer to that immature, wounded, kind of emotional-driven condition part of themselves. We call it what? We call it our inner child. So there's an acknowledgement that there is a significant part of us that is still operating from principles that are what? Childish. Right. And that part of ourselves has not matured, has not grown up, is still operating from needs and wants and traumas and emotionality that were conditioned in childhood. And even though we may be in our 20s, our 30s, our 40s, our 50s, our 60s, our 70s, our 80s and up, that childish part of us may still be very much conditioning. Childish beings look out for themselves. Buddhas, again, labor for the good of others. See the difference that divides them. And again, I think all of us are aware that within us we have these tensions. Right? There is a part of us that is aware of our capacity for goodness, our capacity to care about another and put their needs and wants, if not equal to our own, even sometimes even ahead of our own. And we believe that we want to live a life of kindness and goodness and service and helping human beings and, you know, all that stuff. And we're aware that other people in our own community throughout the world suffer in all kinds of ways, all kinds of deprivations and difficulties, and we want to help them. We want to lessen their suffering. And yet, at the same time, there is often this other part of ourselves that still operates from this very constricted, narrow, self-driven part of ourself that is sort of endlessly, it's almost like we are bifurcating. We have two voices. And obviously spiritual practice is about integration. It is about the healing and transformation of those part of ourselves that needs healing and transformation, so we can manifest ourselves in a way that we might call essentially altruistic, to lead an altruistic life, a meaningful life, a life of connection, interconnection. Now, I wanted to speak a little bit about in the month of January, I was not here teaching, but there were, I guess, at least four members of the community who here in Tampa who were teaching the Four Immeasurables. Is that correct? How many people were able to attend most of those talks? How many people were able to attend one or two of the talks? How many people weren't able to attend any of the talks? Okay, so then let me begin there. And then when I come next, we can kind of begin to take off in this journey on letting go of self-centered living, the path of selflessness. But I mean, the reason the first month of this practice period was related to the Four Immeasurables is because there is no better expression, manifestation of selfless living than is incorporated in these practices and teachings subsumed under the title The Four Immeasurables. The Four Immeasurables refer to, the Buddha called them the Four Immeasurables because they are, their benefit cannot be measured. They are immeasurable. And in these Four Immeasurables, they're often sometimes referred to the Buddha's teachings on love. The Buddha actually, in Buddhism, there is no word for love, actually, which is interesting. In And we know in our own culture, love is a word that has unfortunately almost lost all meaning because it is used in so many ways. And because for many people, love is deeply associated with a temporary insanity, great overwhelming attachment and infatuation, and suffering. There are very few people who have entered the world of love, as it is known, and have not suffered. Right? So therefore, what passes for love, and I'm not saying that is not part of the human experience. But certainly the way we go about love, which I think has a lot to do with this dichotomy between selfish and selfless. And actually, I'm thinking maybe in March or April or doing a workshop on the topic, something related to a relationship as a path of awakening, as a path of real love. But anyhow, so the Buddha really never talked about love in the romantic, attached way that is primarily it is known in our society. But he called it the Four Immeasurables, and within that there are four. And within them we can say this is the Buddha's teachings that we might refer to as love. And these are the teachings on equanimity. These are the teachings on loving kindness. These are the teachings on compassion. And these are teachings on taking joy and the joy of others. And so let me spend a few minutes, even though there was obviously a lot of talk went on, but let me, so we can all kind of catch up and be on the same page. Traditionally, the teachings of equanimity are the fourth, but I like to put them first. Because I think it is only through the practicing of loving kindness, compassion, and joy, and the joy in others, in a way that is shared equally and equitably with all beings, that the real meaning and purpose of what the Buddha meant. In other words, most of us, even when we are touching within ourselves, our capacity to be kind and loving and compassionate and joyful with other beings, we are fairly partial. Partial. We divide it up. Right? We parcel it out. We parcel it out either on usually two criteria. One criteria is biological, right? We call it family, right? And so therefore, because we may call people family, we may feel that they are worthy of our loving kindness, our compassion, and our joy, right? Or else we decide to parcel it out to some people who we have decided, consciously or unconsciously, are worthy of it, right? These people are worthy of my concern. These people are worthy of my deep sense of connection that makes their suffering no different than my own. These are fairly few. And often they are based on our own criteria. Like they share what? My views, my ideas. They're like me. So therefore I'll be concerned about them. Or else, in a certainly more selfish way, it is because what? Because they do good things for me. So therefore, because they do good things, they watch out for me, they're helpful to me, they're kind to me, they do things for me, so therefore I will care about them. Right? So there's that group, right? And then over here, there is that other group. You know, that's the group who don't do any of that, right? They're not part of our family, or they actually could be part of our family. They don't share my views. They don't share my lifestyle. They don't see things the way I do, or they have done things that have displeased me. They have done things that I don't like to myself or others. So therefore, I will put them in the category of they only get my what? My negativity, right? They only get my anger, my disgust, right? I would never be concerned. Actually, secretly, when I hear bad things happen to them, I might even be joyful. We don't want to admit that publicly, it's not that, but there are people who do. And then in the middle is that vast range of people that we are what? Indifferent to. We are neutral. So it's almost like if you think about these positive mind states of loving kindness, of compassion, of joyful, non-jealousy, really taking joy in the joy of others, we have to get the mechanism through which this stuff is being dispersed open, so it's not so segmented and partial. We have to be impartial. This was the Buddha's teaching. We have to be impartial. We have to cultivate a mind and a heart that is open to all beings. It is, if you want an analogy, it is the what? It is the mind and heart of the parent. Right? A good, loving, kind, compassionate parent loves all their children. Is kind to all their children, is understanding of all their children, right? And doesn't, start parceling it out. Parents who parcel it out that way, we call bad parents, don't we? So, we want to develop this mind of equanimity, where we break down these artificial barriers that we have created. Because you might find right now that there are people that you call your friends that weren't your friends before. Actually, if you had run into them in the street before they became your friend, they would be one of those people you were indifferent about. And if somebody told you, hey, did so-and-so, this happened to them, you'd say, so what? I don't know. I don't care. So there are many people who are a friend, there are people that we were indifferent to, and there may be people in our life that they're the people who are on our negative side. And there may be people who are on our friendly side who 2 days later are on our negative side. And 4 days later are back on our positive side. And then they may move into the indifferent side for a few weeks. So it is, and maybe your social political views have changed over the years. So that group that you identify with is, right? Has also changed. And the people you used to identify with, that used to really care about and all that, you really now don't care about at all, or you think they're all a bunch of jerks, or worse. And, so again, knowing this lens through which we see human beings is so fickle, so insubstantial, and so based on self and so based on conditioning and all these variables, the Buddha says, give it up. Give it up. Have an open heart and care for all beings with equanimity, equally. Right? A parent loves their children, the good ones and the not so good ones. The ones that listen and the ones that don't listen. The ones that do what we say and the ones who don't do what we say. We don't stop caring about them. We may be a little frustrated with them. We may be doing tough love with them. But we never stop loving them and caring about them and wanting them to be happy. Is that clear? So equanimity is the foundation for the Buddha's approach for each of us in how to develop this loving, caring heart. It is something that is dispensed you know, equally. Now, when we get to the active aspect of love, there are these three aspects. The first is loving kindness, and you probably, these days, people talk about metta. I mean, not everywhere, but at least in Buddhist circles, you hear metta and metta meditation and stuff like that. Metta refers to this first category, which really just means, it's a wonderful, it means all the natural attributes that we have as human beings in terms of offering friendship to our friends. All these are the qualities, right? So our friends are people that we what? We're happy to see, right? We like them. We care about them. We want them to be happy. We don't want them to suffer, right? We're there for them. We're concerned about them. You know, all those natural feelings that we have for our friends, for those we like, for those we care about. This is loving kindness. This is the kind heart. And this is our natural heart. The capacity to every human being we encounter, we see as a friend. They don't have to be our best friend, right? But we see them as our friend. Again, we may have friends that we're vexed with a little bit these days, right? And yet they're still our friends. We want them to be happy. If they call us, we're there for them. We don't think about it, do we? We're just there for them. Could it possibly be that each of us have this loving heart in us? That actually this is our heart? And that if it wasn't divided up in endless ways, by the way I talked about earlier, through our experience, our conditioning, etc., that it, the reason it closed, the reason it became partial, because it divided up, was only because of our conditioning and because nobody ever taught us. Nobody ever taught us what's being taught now. Right? And that is why you heard in the verse earlier, the Shantideva said, you know, our parents taught us things, but they never taught us this. And how to do it. And that it's not just, you know, a Sunday school kind of idea. Many of us grew up with a kind of a sense of this as this is Sunday school stuff. This is stuff they talk about in church and temple. Right? But this is not the real world. But Buddhism doesn't teach that. This is the world. This is our heart. And all of us have this capacity for offering friendship to every being. And I'll just turn it around. And if I said, is there anybody here that wouldn't like to live in a world where everybody greeted you with friendship? I mean, wouldn't that be nice? When you went to Publix? And it wasn't because they were trained in customer relations, but they actually genuinely were happy to see you. You know, not just the people who wait on us, but the people, right, you know, everywhere, work, home. Wouldn't it be nice? Right? Again, and we'd probably say, yeah. Yeah, I'd like that. That'd be a nice world. Well, then just begin. You can do it. The second one is, so that's metta, or loving kindness. I mean, it could be called many things, or friendship, or karuna, which is the second one, means compassion. And this, more specifically in Buddhism, means compassion is in karuna, the word karuna, the Sanskrit word karuna, is more than empathy. It's more than, you know, I feel your pain, or I feel the suffering. It is an active. So it is the awareness of the suffering of other beings, or the world, or the planet, or animals, or whatever. And it means I kind of concurrently, simultaneously, with that sense of connection, arises a desire to alleviate the suffering. That's compassion. Again, you know, like loving kindness, compassion is not just an invention of Buddhism. Hopefully, all true religions or spiritual path teach that we are here to be compassionate to one another, to see another's suffering as my own. Most of us, unfortunately, are primarily concerned 90% with our own suffering, and maybe leave 5 or 10% for others. Right? What if it was the other way around? I mean, there are certainly more of them than me, just from a numeric point of view, mathematical point of view. I am just one out of many. For me only to be concerned with my own suffering and my own liberation from suffering, isn't that just another kind of selfishness? Not to be aware of the sufferings of all those around me. And again, I mean, just coming back to the turning around, is there anybody here who in their suffering, whatever their suffering is, physical suffering, emotional suffering, relationship suffering, is there anybody here that would not like to live in a world where other people are concerned about your suffering and really want to do anything they can to relieve you and help you? I mean, that's a pretty wonderful world, isn't it? Our self goes, wow, let me get this straight. There's a world where people are friendly and kind and civil to everyone else, and they are as concerned about my suffering and the alleviation of my suffering as their own. Anybody want to sign up for that world? Sounds like a good world to live in. Okay, so here we are again. We cannot make the world change in an instant, but we have the capacity of transforming our own personal world. The third is what's often translated as taking joy in the joy of others. It really means, it's really the antidote to jealousy. Because many of us, we don't take joy in the joy of others. We take joy in the joy of others when they're doing it my way. Right? We don't think, isn't that wonderful that such and such happened to them? We think, I deserve it. I deserve the raise. I deserve the advancement. I deserve good things happening to me. I deserve the loving relationship. You know, we are jealous. You know, I deserve more money. I deserve, you know what I mean? We are jealous about the good fortune of others. But you know, when you are in that loving state and you hear that people you love, family, your children, you are happy, you know, you want them to do better than you, don't you? I'm so happy for them. Can you see it's a natural thing? Because it's not predicated on self. So this joy in the joy of others means, and it also means that we let go. You know, so many of us in our relationships, we are happy when the people in our life are happy in the way we want them to be happy. They're doing the things that make us happy, that we think is right. Then we're happy for them. But if they're happy in ways that we don't like, or that we don't agree with, right? We are what? We're frustrated. We're angry. Right. So this joy in the joy of others is a very powerful change in the mind. Right. Yeah, I am happy that they're happy, even if it's not my way of happiness. You know, even though I wouldn't choose this path in life, or I wouldn't, you know, if this gives them happiness, then I'm happy. It's a letting go. And it's really being selfless in our loving. So, love encompasses, I would call this selfless living. If we can approach relationship, all relationship, again, when we see somebody on the street, when they work with us, when they work for us, when we work under, whatever, when, you know, we are in relationship, can we treat everyone with friendship? Can we care about them when they suffer and want to benefit them, help them? And can we take joy in their joy, even if it's not our own, and never be jealous or partial? And can we do all this in equanimity? So that's the challenge of the Four Immeasurables. But I think they really show us what the human heart is capable of. You know, I am very fortunate these days. I have an 8-month-old grandson. And he every day shows me that these are true. That this is the true state of the human heart. Because he smiles at everybody. He smiles at everybody. He's happy. He smiles at everything. It's wonderful to be reminded how simple it all is and how open our hearts were when we were little, before we learned about self and others, before emotionality and conditioning began to close us off, to see that the wonderful capacity of the human heart, just to be open in such a simple, loving, happy way, and to know that that heart is still here in us. It's just covered over. It's encrusted. That's all. And with some good, deliberate, conscious, intentional cleaning, it can come forward. So before we end, any questions that aren't clear about these Four Immeasurables? And again, I know there were teachings given here over the past month, I'm sure much more profound than mine, but I just wanted to kind of give a summary. Any questions? It's all kind of simple, isn't it? Yeah, what did Shanti Davis said? What need is there of, what do you say? What need is there of? Well, yeah. Is there need for lengthy explanation? Not really. It's kind of simple. The truth is very simple and obvious. And hopefully when we see it, when we experience it, we know it. We go, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I know that. We all know that, don't we? When we put down all the stuff, all the conditioning, all the drama, all the he said, she said, this me, this you, I'm a this, I'm a that, you're a this, you're a... We put that all down, and we go, oh yeah, this is the way to live. Yeah, this is the way to relate. So good. So why don't we stop here and use this as our beginning for this theme journey of letting go of self-centered living, the path of selflessness. And again, please don't consider this a Sunday sermon. I know now we're meeting on Sundays. So people may be confused. Go, let me see, we're in a church and Sunday morning. This just could be the Sunday sermon. A little bit of break, you know, a little bit of chance, and then get back in our car and continue on the way we always have. Please don't do that. It's a waste of these precious teachings. Please take them in and see if they don't make sense to you. Reflect on them and see if you may not want to make shifts and changes in how you approach relationship, how you approach love, how you approach your relationship with beings. You know, beings are all these people running around this world, driving cars, shopping, getting into all kinds of mischief. Yeah. These are sentient beings, the ones we're here to love, take care of, be concerned about, like that. So we'll stop for now.